Welcome to episode 5 of the Haman Lee Mysteries Resolved podcast. My name is Debbie Simons. This week, we're going to zero in on the events leading up to the so-called discovery of Haman Lee's body in the woods of Leakin Park, and we're going to be concentrating specifically on the strange character of Alonzo Sellers. But let's, for just a moment here, go back. In the last episode, I covered the police interviews that concerned Don and his putative alibi. All of them except one with Don himself, although we think there is an unrecorded interview that took place up at Hunt Valley with his mother, Anita Baird, and a man named Thomas Kilbean. And I went into that in great detail in the last episode. And there, of course, was one indirect interview in which Joseph O'Shea called somebody named C.M., who, of course, is Catherine Michelle, at the Owings Mills Lens Crafters and got a set of specific times for Don's work on January 13th. The one interview or checkup that I didn't talk about that I want to start out with today is a report that was commissioned by the Lee family about Don and Adnan. I'm not going to go into great detail here about the ins and outs and whys and wherefores of the Lee family's activities, because there's going to be a whole episode about that. But here, because it concerns Don, and I think it may have had a role in the decision that was made to go ahead and try to report where Hayes' body was, is an interview. It's titled A Missing Persons Report, and it is described on the cover page as having been commissioned by Hayes' uncle, Tae-Soo Kim. But it's not actually a missing persons report at all, because it's not about Hay. It's about Adnan, and it's about Don. And it is made by a company named the Anihi Group. I have much to say about this group, and I have a whole section in my appendix explaining where I think the word Anihi comes from. So for now, I'm simply going to say the group was headed up by a woman named Mandy Johnson, who clearly had an anti-Muslim bias in the way she reported her findings. So in this report, she first of all goes through some ideas about Adnan. This is not the infamous report that she generated later for Baltimore City. This is much more generic, much more bland, but it's not very positive toward Adnan. Interestingly enough, it is also gleaned entirely, if you read it carefully, from Hayes' diary. There is no indication at all that she ever met with Adnan in person. And it may be that this was simply a money-saving technique. It may be that she said, "Why don't you let me read that diary, and if I think I have enough information, then I don't have to charge you for a personal interview." But she did interview Don in person. And just to set the stage here for the things that Don is saying about Hay at this point, we believe that this report was produced sometime in the last week of January. Here's what she says. During the date, which she means on the night of January 12th, which is the last time that Don reported seeing Hay, he claims she told him she'd had an argument with her mother earlier that day and that she had expressed the desire to live with her father in California. Now, as I mentioned last time, Hay's father does not live in California. Now, here's the interesting thing. When asked how she would accomplish this, Mr. Kleindienst seemed to think she could either drive there, that is, drive all the way to California from Maryland, or leave her car in the satellite parking facility at BWI Airport and fly by commercial airline to California. Now, of course, this makes absolutely no sense. It makes less than no sense. So we're supposed to believe that this very ambitious young woman, Haman Lee, who has plans for college, that she's just going to throw everything away, quit her very high-powered high school program that's going to put her very much on the track for college, and go out to stay with someone she barely knows, if indeed Don even has any clear idea of who this person is, this so-called father. But I mention this report here because I think it is simply another nudge along the way of Don's realization that he has to try to explain where Hay is. There are so many questions being asked about her. So now he's trying to come up with a theory about, well, how would she have gotten to California? Well, maybe she left her car in the parking lot at BWI, that's Baltimore Washington International Airport. And I will emphasize once again, by the way, this is a brand new car. This is a 1998 car that Hay had picked up from her grandfather's car dealership back in September of 98. So this makes less than no sense at all. Plus, we know that Hay is planning to go on that trip to France the next month, and she's already bought her tickets, or at least she has the money for the tickets and the other expenses of the trip. That's the source of that $3,000 that she says she has access to that has really puzzled some people. It's just her trip to France money. So Don is again being kind of put under the gun. Where is this girl? Where do you think she is? And so gradually, this is now, we're still in January. Hay's body is not going to be discovered, quote unquote, till February 9th. But I think there is more and more this feeling on the part of Don and his mother and perhaps Catherine Michelle, how much she knows at this point, how much she is involved in these discussions, we don't know. We do know she's involved by February 1st because that's when she reads those times from Don's so-called shift on January 13th over the phone to Joseph O'Shea. Meanwhile, as I mentioned last time, this is on the news constantly. And Hay's family is holding vigils. That's being televised. And they're begging for someone to come forward. And so my theory, and I think I mentioned this last time, is that Anita Baird, who, remember, is not a monster. She's not a criminal. This is just a bolt from the blue that her son has killed this young woman whom she must have met in a fit of rage, as I have postulated. I think the evidence points to that being the case. And she's really torn. She wants to protect her son. That's clear. She goes to great lengths to protect her son. But at the same time, I think she must have really had a lot of feeling for especially Hay's mother. She's a mother. She's protecting her son. And Yoon-Hwa Kim is Hay's mother. She at least deserves to know that her daughter is dead. And so that's, I think, what motivated this whole plan to get somebody to report the body. Well, who can that be? It can't be one of them. What reason would they have for being out in the woods of Leakin Park? Oh, but we have another person. We have another accessory after the fact who's now caught in the meshes of this whole conspiracy, this whole cover-up, and that's Alonzo Sellers. I would venture to guess that at this point, Anita Barrett has done a little bit of checking up on Alonzo Sellers, and she realizes, oh, this guy has a police record. He's been arrested, cited, charged with the misdemeanor of indecent exposure. He has to do what we say. He can't afford any more police trouble. So I believe that she and Don called him and said, look, we need you to do something further. It may be, and here I'm postulating wildly, it may be that Alonzo Sellers is having his own pangs of conscience. I'm sure he owns a television and he's seen those news reports. And when they call him and say, look, we really feel bad about this family of the girl, he may have said, yeah, I've been seeing this. I feel bad for her too. So however the exact procedure is, they cook up this plan. So here's what they come up with. Alonzo Sellers works at what is then Coppin State College. It's now called a university. And it is on the east side of Leakin Park. And the house that Sellers wants to buy, or by this point may have bought, it's a little unclear. I've tried to track down the tax records, and I have not been able to find the exact sequence of events about when he bought this house that is so close to Woodlawn High School, as I mentioned last time. But you can indeed cut through Leakin Park on this kind of narrow winding road called Franklin Town Road, and you can get to this second address of Alonzo Sellers. It is on Gilmore Avenue in Gwynn Oaks, which is a subdivision near Woodlawn. So they think, okay, well, the college and this address cut through Leakin Park, and that's where the body is. So let's come up with a story that would justify Sellers cutting through the park during the day. As I say, I'm not sure that Sellers was already living at that new address, but that's a good excuse. That's a good end point. And I mention in my book that it is actually a better route, if you want to go the most direct way, to go along the top of the park. There's another more major road that goes along the top, but of course Sellers needs to cut through the middle of the park because that's where the body is. So he says that he decides during his lunch hour on February 9th, which is a Tuesday, that he needs a tool. He needs a wood plane. He needs to shave down the top of a door that's sticking, and they don't have the right tool at the college. Now, this, of course, is ridiculous. This would be a very common thing to do, a very common tool to use, but I guess it was the best he could come up with. Maybe he actually did own a wood plane at home, and he thought, well, if they ask me, I can produce it. So he says he went home during his lunch hour to get this tool. And I mean to tell you, if you ever read the trial transcript or you watch the video of Christina Gutierrez questioning him at trial, I'll quote my mother again, she goes all the way around Robin Hood's barn just to ask him the very, very simple question about what job did you need to do at the college? What tool did you need that you didn't have? But her signature, did you not, phrase pops up quite a bit. So Sellers says he headed home. Now he would be going westbound. So the place where they pulled off to take Hay's body back into the woods would have been right there. I don't know that he ever actually went all the way home. That's not at all clear to me. That really wouldn't have made much sense. He's just using that address as an end point. And then he says that when he got home, he got the tool and that he also grabbed a 22-ounce can of Budweiser and he was drinking it in the car on the way back. I will point out here, by the way, that Maryland had at that point, I don't know if they still do, but they probably do. They had an open container law. It was against the law to be driving a vehicle with an open container of alcohol in the car with you that you were drinking from. So, I mean, it's the very definition of drinking and driving, I guess, but nobody seems to really question this. So he says he grabbed a beer and he grabbed the plane and he went back. Now he's driving eastbound. So now the place where Hay is hidden is across the road. And he says, well, I got about 5 minutes from the college and all of a sudden, this isn't exactly the way he worded it, but this is what he's saying. All of a sudden, I was overwhelmed with the need to go to the bathroom. I couldn't wait until I got to the college campus where there are bathrooms all over the place. No, I had to pull off so that I could get out and relieve myself in the woods. But if you parse out his movements, he parks on the opposite side of the road from where Hay's body is. He has to cross the road and he has to plunge into the woods, and Hay's body is about 125 feet, it's a little bit more, to those huge fallen logs. Then he has to clamber over the logs, one of them, and then he almost steps on her. He says, I looked down and I saw hair, and then I saw foot. So then we are to imagine him scrambling back up over that log and getting all the way across the road, out of the woods, across the road, back in his truck, and he gets to the college and he tells his supervisor about this. Now, as we're going to see here in just a minute, he apparently talks to this supervisor quite a bit because this guy, I don't know his name, has some very interesting things to say about Alonzo Sellers, which we'll get to in a minute. But he helps Sellers, is what we're told, although if some of the stories about Sellers are true, Sellers doesn't need any help calling the police. But I think he wanted a witness. He wanted somebody to be able to say, oh man, Sellers came in and he was all flustered and he had discovered something terrible and he needed to call the police. He was very concerned. I think that's what we're supposed to believe. So Sellers calls, there's a recording of him saying, I think I may have found a body. And so now it would be the Baltimore City Police send somebody out. And of course, Sellers knows who this is, if I'm correct in my assessment of this case. But he doesn't tell the police who he thinks it is. So he just says, I found a body. So they come out, a group of investigators comes out, and he takes them to the place. And there are a couple of interesting things said by various people in that group. So one of them said, he seemed very calm, almost as if he'd put her there himself, which I think is pretty perceptive. Somebody else said it was kind of strange because he almost didn't seem to quite know exactly where the body was. And I've almost wondered, he knows where it is in general, of course, that it's over on the other side of that log, but it's not necessarily all that obvious. She's not buried, but she's covered somewhat. And Rabia said that when she visited the site, she originally went to the wrong tree. I think Sellers surely must have gone back there just to make sure that Hay was still there, though. I can't imagine that he just stood there and said to himself, yeah, that's the tree. Okay, I know where to take them. And of course, as I explained last time, those Jersey barriers that mask an opening in the guardrail are pretty obvious. So he knows where this is. We know they must have parked there. But now he's on the other side of the street. I don't know. It's impossible to know what he did or did not do. Now, let me address here one of the more absurd theories about what Sellers was really up to. Because he was known. He had a record of indecent exposure. There have been some people, some well-meaning people, including Colin Miller, who have said, well, maybe he was streaking back there in the woods. That is utter and complete balderdash. All due respect to Colin Miller, but it makes less than no sense. For one thing, it's winter. It's February. The temperatures are in the 40s. It's not, 20 below zero, but it's not a balmy summer day. And so it would not be terribly comfortable to take off all your clothes and go prancing around in the woods. And besides, we're talking about twigs and brambles and leaves and fallen branches, maybe. It would be very uncomfortable to be walking around barefoot out there and things reaching out to snag you in various places. That just makes no sense. Plus, as I point out in my book, I point out here, this is so obvious that it almost doesn't need pointing out, but there it is. Indecent exposure or exhibitionism or flashing, however you want to put it, is done to shock other people. You are not committing an act of indecent exposure when you take your clothes off to get in the shower. So I don't know. I don't know why anybody thinks that, but that seems to have been the idea that will not die. So Sellers brings them out there. It doesn't take the police very long to figure out this must be that missing girl, that missing 18-year-old Korean girl, Haemin Lee. And so then, of course, the Lees are notified. This is the news they have been expecting but dreading. Now it is confirmed. Now they know. So Sellers probably went home and thought, okay, I hope that is the last thing I have to do about this girl and her murder. But of course, the police are not quite as dense as people try to say they are. They realize that his story doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. So they call him in for a lie detector test. I'm not going to stop here and go into a long disquisition about how lie detector tests work. I will simply say that they are based on involuntary responses to the stress that you experience when you are lying. Obviously, if a person is a habitual liar, a lie detector test doesn't really do much. So you're hooked up to this machine. We all have seen it with the little marker that marks squiggles on the paper. And it's measuring changes in respiration rate, heart rate, and your blood pressure. And if there's a spike, that's supposed to indicate deception. Lie detector test results are not admitted in court, because it has been recognized for a long time that they're very, very undependable. Nevertheless, they can be helpful in at least a first step in an investigation. So Sellers is called in and he is asked four questions. Now, I got these questions off of Colin Miller's blog, Evidence Prof blog. So here they are. Number one, are you attempting to withhold any information about the death of the female you found in the park? No. Number two, did you do anything to that girl to cause her death? No. Three, had you ever been in the company of that girl you found before the day you found her? No. And four, had you ever been to the spot where the girl was found before the day you found her? No. Now, if my theory about Sellers' involvement in hiding the body is correct, he is lying on number one, do you know anything, but you're trying to withhold it? And number four, had you ever been to the place where you supposedly found her? Those two would have indicated deception. I do not have access to the specific results, which questions indicated deception. I'm just saying, it would have had to be at least those two. So what was the reason for this? Well, the excuse that was given later, I guess, by Sellers himself was that he was nervous because he and his wife were supposed to meet a realtor that day to look at a house, and he was afraid that the lie detector test was going to go on long enough that he was going to be late. And I think it's fair to point out here, just so we all have a clear idea, you don't get called in for a polygraph test and just get asked the questions that the police are interested in, or the potential employee, or whatever. Boom, boom, boom. No, if it's a good polygraph administrator, what they do, what the person does, is ask you some generic questions, like, where do you live? What's your favorite color? All kinds of just very bland questions. And then suddenly, there will be a real question. Are you attempting to withhold any information about the death of the female you found in the park? And it's supposed to take you by surprise. So you've been going along answering all of these easy questions, and all of a sudden you're asked something that is incriminating. So it's not a fast and easy procedure. I don't know how long this test took. But Sellers says, look, I was nervous. I was afraid I was going to be late, which of course does not explain why he was only nervous about certain of these questions. So the police say, yeah, buddy, okay, let's have you come back in. So he is called back in several days later. And this time he's asked a totally different set of questions. Basically, he's asked about different ways that Hay might have been killed. Was she stabbed with a knife? Was she shot? Was she poisoned? Was she choked? Was she hit with a baseball bat? Was she hit with a tire iron? Was she run over by a car? And he says, no, none of those things happened to her. Well, remember, the way I described this situation, I don't think Sellers had any clear idea at all of how Hay had died. I think he could confidently answer no to all of these questions and show no deception. But people have said, well, now wait a minute. Why was he asked these totally different questions? And even the great Rabia Chaudhry says, well, common sense would dictate that you would ask the same questions. No, common sense would not dictate that, because now Sellers knows what he's going to be asked. So Rabia needs to go back and listen to her own podcast, season one of Undisclosed, way back in 2015. And there is an episode in which Colin Miller interviews an actual polygraph expert. I believe it's one of the addendum episodes. And this expert tells Colin, look, of course you wouldn't ask the same questions. Your suspect, or your subject, I guess would be a better word, knows those questions. They're not going to take him by surprise, and so, of course, he's not going to show any deception. You ask different questions, hoping to follow up on the deception, see if he's still showing deception. So the fact that Sellers was asked these other questions is an indication, actually, that the polygraph test was administered correctly. Now, maybe there should have been more questions. So in the relaunch of Undisclosed, there's a bonus episode in which the lawyer, Becky Feldman, who worked with the files of juvenile offenders who had been given life sentences and who was the one who was very instrumental in getting Adnan released from prison in September of 2022, says, well, that lie detector test of Alonzo Sellers was not followed up properly. But she doesn't really explain in what way it was not followed up properly. And it is fair to say that in general, the idea of asking completely different questions is perfectly legitimate. So Sellers is let go. He's never called in again but he is going to be asked to come in and testify at trial about the discovery of the body. So I've already mentioned, Christina Gutierrez asks him her usual confusing roundabout questions. He's very, I don't know what word I would use, snippy with her. He's very clearly unhappy about having to be there. And it's Urich, I believe, who says, are you having to be off work in order to come here today? And he says, yes. And then I believe Urich asks something to the effect of, are you losing out on money, on your pay, for having to take off work for this? And I believe Gutierrez objects. So Urich is clearly trying to explain why Sellers is so very uncomfortable and very hostile in his testimony. Well, there's a perfectly reasonable explanation for this, he seems to be saying, in case anybody's looking at Sellers and thinking, boy, does he look uncomfortable. I wonder if he's covering something up. I want to stop here. This didn't really fit in with my narrative last time, but it fits in here. The relaunch of Undisclosed had a very strange theory about Sellers. And I think that it is completely nonsensical. But I wanted to put it in here because it shows that you can have expert opinion that in general is perfectly correct. But then when you start trying to apply it specifically to the situation you're trying to examine in detail, it falls apart. General expert information has to apply specifically. And so in this case, there are only a few episodes of this relaunch that have to do with Adnan Syed, the first four episodes, I believe, and then there's a bonus. Rabia Chaudhry calls in a woman named Sarah Kalin. This is not Sarah Koenig, the journalist and writer and narrator of Serial. I'm sure she gets this all the time. It's Kalin, C-A-E-L-A-I-N, I believe. And she is an investigator. She is a former police detective, homicide detective. She has a lot of experience in dealing with murder cases and body disposal and all that kind of thing. So Rabia takes her to the place where the pull-off is, and then they trek back to the place where Hayes' body was found. And Kalin has this, I have to say, very strange theory. She says that as soon as she saw this location where there are the barriers that are solid, so you could hide something behind it, and then there's the place where the body was actually found, over 125 feet in, she says, oh, I think the body was put in two different places. So here's her theory for what it's worth. I don't think it's worth much, frankly. I just put it in here because I find it so gobsmacking. So she says, one of the things, and here's where her expert opinion comes in, and this is perfectly true. One of the things that motivates a murderer, if he or she has a body, is the absolute need to not have that body associated with himself or herself, to get that body away from any kind of situation that is related to the perpetrator. Now, obviously, sometimes a person is killed somewhere that has no relation to the murderer, and then the murderer just gets out as fast as possible. But if a person has been killed in a situation related to the perpetrator, then that needs to be taken care of immediately. So Kalin postulates a theory in which the murderer and probably possibly an accessory are driving down Franklin Town Road with the body probably in the back seat, maybe in the trunk, but they're driving along. Now remember, this has to be very, very soon after the murder, or it has to be after that postmortem lividity has already been fixed and the body has been laid flat somewhere. So we've got difficulties right away with this theory because, of course, the back seat of a car, or especially the trunk of a car, does not allow for Hayes' body to be laid out flat. But they're driving along. They spot this pull-off just as I postulated Sellers did the actual morning that this body was put in the woods. And they pull over and they take the body out really quickly and they dump it over the other side of that barrier. And then they leap in the car and they drive off. And Rabia Chaudhry says, oh, well, that would explain how Hayes' body was laid flat. No, it doesn't. Because this whole scenario that Kalin lays out postulates that this was done in a hurry. So then we go back to what I already said, which was this would have to be after the postmortem lividity had formed. But now that means that the murderer has been hiding this body somewhere else for 8 to 10 hours, and only then is the body dumped over that barrier. And I'm not sure, it would really depend on how long this was, whether the body would still be in rigor or whether rigor would have passed off. So the forensics make no sense. You cannot dump a body over the concrete barrier and have it land perfectly flat. And, oh, by the way, guess what starts to be the case with the ground on the other side of that barrier? This is said directly in the podcast. The wood start. It's not a flat, smooth surface. It's dirt. It's gravel. It's some rocks. It's twigs. It's leaves, all of which would have made an imprint on Hayes' body, even had she been laid flat. And of course, she can't have been. Otherwise, you have the totally nonsensical scenario of the murderer pulls up, he and his accomplice leap out, they take out Hayes' body, and then they very carefully arrange her face down on the other side of that barrier. And then they leap into the car and drive off. No, my friends, no, that none of that happened. That makes no sense. Then Kalin postulates, and this is where we start getting into what I would call the wild blue yonder. Sellers comes driving along and he spots the body, she says. In fact, let me just read you what she says exactly. This is a transcript of her exact words from the Undisclosed Relaunch episode. She says, the body got dropped off. Somebody came along and saw it, and rather than reporting it, was very excited, was sexually aroused, and they were the ones who took the time to move her further back so that they could revisit the body. And that, to me, screams that someone revisited her remains multiple times, probably as masturbatory material. And then, as it became obvious that this was a big case, that the whole county was looking for this girl, that the whole state was looking for this girl, that this was a big unsolved disappearance, that this person understandably got spooked and either stopped going back, or if in fact it was Sellers, fabricated this reported story in order to be able to say that he found her without having to tell the actual circumstances. Oh, I have no words here. I just have no words. Let's take this initial statement. The body got dropped off. Somebody came along and saw it. Now, how exactly would that happen? Because the murderers would have dumped her on the other side of this barrier. And they don't really care if somebody sees her, because they just want to get rid of the body. But surely they would have been kind of careful that her head wasn't poking out one end or her feet were not poking out the other end. And you're driving along Franklin Town Road, which is narrow and winding, But I'm going to say the speed limit is probably 30 miles an hour. How would you even spot this? That makes no sense to me. Now, if she had just been dumped out of the car on the other side of the guardrail, of course, that is a very, very different situation. But that's not what this is. This is a concrete barrier that's, I'm going to say, 3 feet tall, at least. And unless you were actually looking, you would not see that there was something huddled behind it. That makes no sense to me at all. Then Kalen says, Sellers was excited. And so he moved her body back in the woods to where she was found so that he could revisit her. Well, folks, I don't know. We do know that Sellers, as I've said before, was a weird dude. But I'm not sure that necrophilia is part of his weirdness. That does not seem to have cropped up anywhere else. We do, however, know a couple of things about Sellers that the police did not know at the time. So I'm just going to let Sarah Kalen's little theory kind of come to rest here, and we will hope die a natural death. However, remember I said earlier that Sellers seems to have been friends with his superintendent or confided in his superintendent, because there are a couple of little nuggets of information in that same podcast episode that are very relevant and very interesting. And they don't say what the source is of these statements by the superintendent. Remember, this is the man who helped Sellers call the police. So first of all, he says that Sellers kind of had a thing for young Asian girls. How does he know this? Sellers must have told him. And let me make the second point here, and then we'll kind of look at these two statements in conjunction with each other. The second thing that the superintendent says is that Sellers made a practice of taking sex workers back into Leakin Park. So although Sellers tells the police, no, I've never been to Leakin Park before, he most certainly has. He has, shall we say, intimate knowledge of at least certain parts of Leakin Park. So the idea that Sellers was stimulated, fascinated, interested by discovering Hayes' body is certainly tenable in light of what Kalen says. And maybe she's correct that one of the reasons why Sellers was willing to help hide Hayes' body in the first place is that he thinks, I can come back and revisit her for whatever reason that might be. So that part of the story is quite interesting. But this idea that Sellers somehow spots this body through a cement barrier, I don't think he has X-ray vision like Superman, and then would have risked at some point lugging that body back into the woods by himself, and it would have almost had to be during the daytime because I just don't know. The whole thing makes no sense. But we do know that Sellers has a connection, a sexual connection with Leakin Park, with a young Asian girl, and that may help in some way explain his willingness to stay involved with this case. There is another story about Alonzo Sellers and his supposed story to an undercover police officer, a story that Rabia gets at about fifth hand from another true crime podcaster, and she does check up on the story as much as she can. I was going to go into this in this episode, and I decided it was just too convoluted. I'll post a link to that specific episode in the show notes for this, And you can go back and listen to it if you would like to. The end result is, I think it is clear, when all is said and done, that the story that Sellers told about discovering Hay's body cannot possibly be true, and that the only way he would really have known where she was is if he had helped put her there, or he had watched somebody else put her there, but I don't see how that could be possible. There's always been this persistent theory. This was put forward in the original Undisclosed podcast, season one, by the way, that maybe what happened was that Sellers had simply heard something. And because of his proclivities, it was considered to be possible, I don't think we have proof of this, that he was actually a customer at the pornographic video rental store where Jay Wilds worked. But that couldn't be anything to do with Jay Wilds if we're trying to pull him in, because Wilds didn't start working at that store till later on in February. And you would have to have something very, very specific. You'd have to overhear the murderer and his accomplice discussing as they're making their selection from the vast array of, what would they be then, videotapes. Oh, yes, we parked at that white concrete barrier and we went 125 feet to that big fallen log, and then we dumped the body over. And that was about half a mile from the parking lot where you can park for the pavilion and the trailhead and that kind of thing. That's what we did. No, that did not happen. So we're going to leave Sellers there. And next week, I haven't quite decided where we're going to go from here. I think next week, since I'm on the theme of strange people in this case, maybe we'll do Jay. So come next week, and we will probably have the episode titled, What About Jay? That is, Jay Wilds, the black hole at the center of this case. See you then.